bottom line of all this is that if you set up a rhombic with the right angles and the right length of wire, it becomes an extremely high gain antenna as far as the main lobe is concerned, the boresight lobe that flows down the mechanical boresight of that antenna. And so it's a fairly simple antenna, just with a little bit of smart in the way you select the wire length and the wire angles. A rhombic antenna can give you numbers like 20 decibels of gain, and you can decide if the gain is going to be unidirectional or bidirectional. If you put a 600 ohm load resistor at the far end of the rhombic, and each of the rhombic legs are, let me pick a number, 4 wavelengths long, if you've got enough property to do all this, you end up with a tremendous amount of forward gain, and you properly tune that 600 ohm resistor at the far end of the rhombic, and you can have a front-to-back
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can have a front-to-back ratio of numbers like 20 decibels out of the rhombic. And if by remotely controlling the relay, you open up the 600 ohm resistor, you can make most of the front-to-back ratio disappear, and you can fire in both directions. So you can do electronic steering with it, but it's a very simple-looking antenna as a schematic on a page, but it's capable of a whole lot of gain. There is a man in Australia who decided to make a multiple acre antenna, which was three stacked rhombics. I think they were about 1,000 foot from front to back altogether on 2 meters. He aimed that antenna at a particular point in space, and each month when the moon would sweep through that point in space, he did 2 meter moon bounce with a rhombic antenna. I think it was VK5ZAD, but I'm not sure of the call letters right now. But there was an amateur who, for quite a number of years, was doing some very effective moon bounce from Australia with a rhombic antenna. A rhombic antenna usually is used on HF frequencies. He was using it on a VHF frequency, 2 meters. And I think there are people who have talked about using a rhombic on 432. There was an antenna game competition in which K2UIH, Alan Katz, from Trenton State College, entered a 1296 megacycle rhombic antenna that he handheld. And it did present something like 15 or 18 dB of gain, as I remember. A fairly effective antenna, and a rather simple-looking pair of wooden flats with a piece of wire strung between the wooden flats. So you read the section on rhombic antenna out of the antenna handbook, and you'll see some very interesting data. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yes, it's Sam. There was a very interesting experiment that was done with rhombic antennas some years ago, I remember reading. And they all showed that a rhombic antenna was very easily capable of, for instance, if you were using it on HF, still need the real estate, as Dick just said. You went to a rhombic that you'd like to see with a, you know, a gain somewhere upwards of about 8, 9, or 10 dB gain, which can be achieved. You're looking at something that, you know, really grows in size quite fast. The point is that the rhombic, the classic rhombic, and basically if you want to compare it to the loop, yes, they both are square in shape. They are, I guess, the rhombic is usually much larger, and the difference is that what they do, they would feed the rhombic at one corner, and at the opposite corner, you would put the what they call terminating resistors. And usually, because if you went to a rhombic, in most cases, the resistance at that corner was measured, a fairly high resistance around, around 800 ohms or something, usually was the resistance that they would measure. So to bring that down, what they would do, I remember one of the rhombics that they featured in the magazine, to reduce it so that you could use 450 ohms or so, you know, meters. Was rather, actually, the 450 ohm actually was 430 ohm or so, 450 ohm. What they would do, on the opposite point where you feed the rhombic, they would put terminating resistors right there. And usually I print up those 800 ohms you measured at the beat point by putting, I'd say, at that point, 400 plus ohm resistance to make up the that 800 ohm. You could then match it with the 450 ohm line. So that was basically it. I can say, as Vic just said, properly installed, the rumble can do a heck of a lot for you. Just that you really need the real estate. Go ahead, Vic.
Yeah, the rhombic is not exactly square. It's a little bit more diamond-shaped in the usual configuration, the usual way guys set it up. The rhombic and beverage are the two main antennas that are called a traveling wave antenna. That's a fancy way of saying a signal travels down the wire once and gets absorbed at the terminating resistor at the far end, but a little bit didn't get radiated. It's a traveling wave antenna because the signal travels only once in one direction and stops. Almost all other antennas we use, like dipoles and Yagis and ground planes and whatever, are a standing wave antenna. The signal bounces back and forth on the antenna 30 times before it gets radiated into space, and therefore the antenna resonance is defined as having all those 30 bounces all stay co-phase with each other, all lockstep with each other, because if the antenna is a little bit too short, and they start falling out of phase with leading phase, we say the antenna is capacitive, and it presents capacitive reactance. The nice thing about a rhombic is because it is a traveling wave antenna, the signal travels down there once and gets determinated, the rhombic can be an extremely broadband antenna. Properly designed, you could probably use a rhombic over at least a 2-to-1 and maybe a 10-to-1 frequency range. A very broadband antenna. At first, the average amateur looks at that terminating resistor at the far end, and he says, gee, I'm taking my valuable RF energy, I'm putting it into a resistor, I'm burning it up, I'm turning it into heat, and I'm wasting it. The average amateur has a whole lot of pushback when he first sees the diagram of a rhombic and see that it requires a resistor at the far end. Well, that resistor is there to make sure that the signal flows once in one direction, and therefore the antenna develops a very good front-to-back ratio. Without the resistor, what energy that's left over starts flowing backwards on the wire, and you get lobes in the other direction. You and I recall that a back lobe response. And in some cases, you want the back lobe response. It'll always be weaker because there's not as much energy left over, but you can control the front-to-back ratio by that terminating resistor. And if you're real smart, you've got a set of relays where you can attach yourself to the feed line that feeds the far end where the terminating resistor was, and put the terminating resistor on what you and I would call the near end, and now you can fire the signal very strong in the back direction instead of the forward direction. You can measure the long path versus the short path response when you're talking to that guy in Australia or Africa or England, and there are times when the long path is a stronger signal than the short path, depending on the state of the ionosphere and which portion of the Earth is being lit up with the sunlight today. Rhombic and beverage, very interesting.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So rhombic and beverage are very interesting traveling wave antennas. They both require a terminating resistor in the pure form. And once you get past the repulsion of using a resistor, it can gain you some very nice performance. There are people who have set up a rhombic antenna with bows and arrows, just laying the wire across the tops of the trees on their acre of property, and end up with a whole lot of gain in one particular direction. And some really enthusiastic guys will set up a rhombic to the east, and a rhombic to the north, and a rhombic to the south, and feed the right rhombic at the right time to talk to the right guy. And I can make you a big gun. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Okay, we're going to hold this button. All right, very good. Yes, very interesting antenna. Been around a long time and still is quite effective. And it's an antenna that if you have the real estate, I highly recommend it. It works quite well. All right, let's see. What else have we got? Hold on, I'm reading. Let's see, you guys have talked about operating at 10 gigs, people that have operated at 40, 7 gig and everything, does not it, is it true that if you go up above a certain point, you no longer, you know, still consider it RF signal? For instance, isn't the cutoff, I'm trying to understand it. Oh, the cutoff, is the cutoff actually of RF, of the RF transmission of signals at 300 gigs at the point where it becomes infrared, I think. In other words, they're asking that when you get, I think he's trying to ask you, at the point where you get, you know, above 300 gigs, I guess we're actually entering the infrared zone. Is that still considered radio frequency, Dick, over?
Yeah, Mother Nature's spectrum, DC to light, DC to X-ray, DC to comic, DC to cosmic ray, it's really one continuous frequency band. The lower frequencies around 60 hertz, we call that power. The middle frequencies around 1 kilohertz, we call that audio. The upper frequencies around a megacycle, we call that AM broadcast. 3 to 30 megacycles, we call it high frequency ham radio. 50 megacycles to 215 megacycles, we call it channel 2 to 13 television. And from 470 to 890 in the old days, we used to call it channel 14 to 83 UHF television, and so on. We got different names for these, but it's the exact same spectrum. What he's really asking is where the light begin. Where does light begin? And the easiest way I can clear that one up is once you study VHF and UHF, you have a little bit of a feeling for what is 600 megacycles. 600 megacycles, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm going to guess it's somewhere around channel 70 UHF television. 600 megacycles is roughly half the frequency of ham radio 1296, but it's really three times the ham radio frequency of 222 megacycles. So 600 megacycles, we got a little feeling for what that is. Go 1 million times higher in frequency than 600 megacycles, and you're right in the middle of the optical band. You're looking at the front panel of your ham radio rig right now. You're looking at it with a frequency, which is 10 to the 14 hertz. The optical people will call it 550 nanometers of wavelength. But the frequency your eye is operating at is 1 million times higher than 600 megacycles, rounding off the numbers a little bit. So, as you can tell, upper microwave, let me drop. Upper microwave, millimeter wave, submillimeter wave, gigahertz, terahertz signals, they're very high in frequency compared to what we're used to, but it's a long way away from the frequencies of optics, even far infrared. Got a long, there's a huge gap between what we call radio and what we call optical and far infrared. There's a huge gap in there that we're very slowly filling up. The highest frequencies that anyone uses with any real frequency of laboratory experiments is roughly 1 terahertz, 1,000 gigahertz, 10 to the 12 hertz. That's about the highest we really use even with laboratory experiments. Very few people go beyond a terahertz. It takes some very exotic equipment to do that. Well, the lowest frequency of optics that your eye works on is 10 to the 14. It's 100 times higher than that. So, again, it gives you a little bit of a feeling. Did I get that right? I think so. 10 to the 14 versus 10 to the 12, yes. Terahertz is 10 to the 12, and optical is, I think, something like 4 times, or 5 times 10 to the 14. So it's 500 times higher in frequency. So there's a great big gap in there. And so if I could feed a higher and higher frequency to my dipole, and I'm looking at it in the dark room, if I fed a high enough frequency to my dipole, the dipole would glow. I would eventually see optical frequencies coming off that dipole. I didn't say that's an easy experiment to do, but it does get the point across that it's the same continuous spectrum. And you use different techniques to generate, you use different techniques to detect and receive and aim and focus, but it really is the exact same spectrum. Many of the radio techniques that are used at microwave and millimeter wave and submillimeter wave frequencies are really optical. You can really set up a magnifying glass at just millimeter wave frequencies, and it works like a charm. So whether you're focusing that optical sunlight with your magnifying glass on that newspaper and burning a hole in it, or whether you're putting the radio equivalent, a foam lens, the shape of a magnifying glass, in front of your horn antenna, and using quasi-optical techniques at millimeter wave frequencies, it's almost the exact same technique. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, let's expand upon this a little bit. You mentioned going up into terahertz. When we get above, say, 300 gigs, I believe we are now into the, that's a sub-millimeter wavelength? I think so. In other words, at 1 terahertz, I believe that is the sub-millimeter, or what they call infrared. At that point, you say this experiment that has been done, I would think maybe we're experiencing more, actually, like you say, doing things with optics. I understand it, you know, we can't see it. It's not visible light because, as you said, I think you said that visible light is somewhere around 10 to the 14, or 10 to the 15th hertz. I believe you said that. If I'm not correct, just correct me. But if you're doing experiments with that, would we be generating, basically, I think that they're trying to bring out, that we'd be generating more or less whatever we're generating a signal. Basically, you just say we're really working strictly now with a light wave, maybe using some kind of a device to develop light, and not really considering it as a... radio, as you know, as we think radio, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think you're on to something here. The highest ham band that hams are populating with significant numbers these days is the 10 gig ham band, 10.368. Why that crazy number? It's the 168th harmonic of 144 meg. The average guy, when he first builds himself a 10 gig receiving converter, he wants to hear a weak signal. He turns on his 144.0 megacycle transmitter and listens to the 168th harmonic. And he'll hear it on 10 gigs coming down the horn. So 10 gigs, it's a 1-inch wavelength. They also call it 3 centimeters. Wavelength is 3 centimeters. If I go up to 30 gigs, the wavelength is 1 centimeter. Anything beyond 30 gigahertz, higher in frequency, you're below 1 centimeter, and that's the beginning of the millimeter wave region. The millimeter wave region is 30 gigahertz to 300 gigahertz. The wavelength of 30 gigahertz is 10 millimeters, or 1 centimeter. The wavelength of 300 gigahertz is 1 millimeter. So, the millimeter wave region, 30 to 300 gigs. When you go above 300 gigs, you're below 1 millimeter of wavelength. They call it the submillimeter wave band. So the 1 terahertz frequency region is really a third of a millimeter. You're way into the submillimeter wave region. Terahertz is 10 to the 12 hertz. Optical light is something like 4.5 times 10 to the 14 hertz. So 450 times higher in frequency than a terahertz is optical. The ways that you focus the beam, you don't use dipoles up there anymore. You could use a dipole at 10 gigs. I built one. It's so darn small looking, it looks kind of silly. up there, you tend to use horn waveguides, parabolic dishes, and quasi-optical techniques like lenses is what you tend to use from 10 gigs and above to aim the signal. The parabolic dish is the most popular antenna between 10 gigs and 300 gigs. Almost every ham up there, and Justin, I can't think of Justin's last name right now. WA1, can't think of his call letters. The guy who holds the distance record on the frequencies from 120 gigs and above. Brian Justin, WA1ZMS, Zebra Mike Sierra. You Google those call letters and you'll see some beautiful pictures of the hardware he has built with his own hands to do contacts on 120, 140, 240, 1.
Repeater, timeout,
241, 300 gigs, 400 gigs. He has built hardware with his own hands to operate on those frequencies in two-way contacts over distances like 10 miles. And what kind of range you get on those upper frequencies is strictly a function of the quality of the hardware you use. On 10 gigahertz, everyone used to believe the signal would only go like a flashlight beam. You'd only be able to talk line of sight, and that's it. Well, I've talked to people in 10 states on 10 gigs. I've never run more than 0.2 watt. I've never run an antenna bigger than a 2-foot diameter dish. My best distance is 380 miles to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. You get a band opening some portion of every 24-hour day on 10 gigs if you live within 200 miles of a major body of water like the Atlantic Ocean. You get the super refraction phenomenon. When you get a moist layer of air down low and drier air up high, like you do beyond 12 o'clock at night, the wave bends downward, follows Earth's curvature, and that guy 380 miles away sounds like he's in your backyard, even though he's only running milliwatts of power on 10 gigs. So, as amateurs go to the higher and higher frequencies, starting off at 200 meters and down, way back in the days of a couple of megacycles, everyone believed way back in 1920 that anything above a couple of megacycles was useless. Until the hams went there, started developing the hardware, and started saying, well, the ionosphere reflects signals, sporadic e-clouds reflect signals, the aurora borealis reflects signals, meteors reflect signals, the moon reflects signals, aircraft reflect signals. You'd be amazed how many ways you can propagate a signal as you go to higher and higher frequencies. We keep repeating that experiment. Let me drop. Every 10 or 15 years, the hams go up 10 to 1 in frequency range. Everyone says, well, you're wasting your time on those higher frequencies. There's nothing useful up there. And we keep rediscovering that they're very useful frequencies. When will this end? I don't think it's going to end when we're using optical techniques, and hams are using laser communication techniques. The current ham radio distance record with purely optical techniques, laser diodes, is something like 155 miles. Two telescopes aimed at each other with laser emitters at the eyepiece of the telescope and a laser detector at the other end. 155 miles. So it's a continuous spectrum. The methods by which you generate the signal change, the method by which you detect the signal change, the method by which you focus the signal and develop gain in the antenna looks a little bit different, but it's the exact same spectrum. When we talk about DC to light or DC to X-ray, we're only half kidding. The really progressive amateurs would really like to operate DC to X-ray. KQKUI, KQLIW.
You brought up an interesting point with use of lasers. Is it true that they have one, it's still there, I don't know if anything happened to it, but there was a mirror placed on the moon and that they actually were able to shine a laser beam on that mirror and measure the exact distance to the moon? Was this a legitimate experiment they overcame?
Absolutely. The astronauts on either Apollo 12 or 14, I'm not sure which, deposited on the moon a retroreflector corner cube array It's a whole bunch of corner cubes. I've actually seen the thing in the photograph. It looked to me like it's a foot and a half or 2 foot square, made up of a whole bunch of corner cubes. It was set on the lunar surface with the broadside aimed at the Earth. And for years and years now, the optical telescopes, I think in Arizona, will aim a laser beam at that retroreflector, measure the precise distance between Earth and Moon by looking at the echo off of that retroreflector. And we are reconfirming that the Moon is moving out something like 1 inch per year. The orbit of the Moon is slowly getting larger. The coupling action between the tides of the Earth and the Moon is coupling rotational energy from the Earth into the Moon, and the Moon's orbit is very slowly expanding. And you can make that precise measurement with a laser rangefinder on a good-sized telescope in Arizona on a clear day by echoing off that retroreflector array on the Moon. It's a completely passive device, and except for a little dust forming on it from time to time, it's going to be operational for hundreds of years in the future, if not longer. So that is a thoroughly operational device. Back to you, Mel, K2LIW.
Very fascinating. All right, just to finish this up, one more question just came to mind. If we consider the radio spectrum as, you know, we envision it, say, from, say, 3 kilohertz to 300 gigahertz, anything after that, we're actually dealing with light, I would assume, when we get into infrared, visible light, ultraviolet light. What comes after that? I think after ultraviolet, what comes? X-rays? What comes after X-rays? Gamma rays? Something? What is the top? Is cosmic rays the top, considered the top of the spectrum, Dick? The end of the spectrum? Spectrum somewhere, I don't know, 10 to the, what, 20-something, like 20-foot power or something of that sort. Is that what they call cosmic rays, Dick, over?
You're on the right wavelength, Phil. 300 gigahertz is a nice high frequency at the beginning of sub-millimeter wave. Terahertz is well into the sub-millimeter wave. A third of a millimeter wave is terahertz. That's about the highest anyone goes with radio techniques today. Far infrared is around 10 microns wavelength. Near infrared is a couple of microns. Optical is half a micron, or 550 nanometers. That's the middle of green optical. As you go up in frequency or down in wavelength, you come to near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet. The next thing is X-ray, near X-ray, far X-ray, could be called soft X-ray, hard X-ray as you go up in frequency. The next thing is gamma ray, and they're about to install in space in the beginning of next year a very high resolution gamma ray telescope. We're about to see with high resolution what the universe looks like in gamma ray. Each individual photon, the smallest pocket of energy at any of these frequencies, is called a photon. And the difference between ionizing and non-ionizing, a couple of electron volts of energy, is right around the optical frequencies. The optical frequencies are right in the dividing line between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. By the time you get up to ultraviolet, you're well into ionizing radiation, obvious by the fact that the ultraviolet rays, particularly the far ultraviolet rays, are the ones that will give you sunburn. There's enough energy in each individual photon that when it strikes your body, it is capable of making a chemical change to the cells of your body. That's one of the definitions of ionizing radiation. So, far ultraviolet can do that. Soft X-ray and hard X-ray can do it. We're going up in energy at each individual photon. By the time you get to cosmic ray, gamma rays, you're getting into the really big numbers of energy per photon. Gamma rays, when they strike the Earth, hit the upper atmosphere, and they cannot get through the whole atmosphere. And that's good news, because if they did, they would be giving us quite a bit of damage. The atmosphere stops them, but they create a cascade. In other words, a really energetic gamma ray hitting the top of the ionosphere, the top of the atmosphere, creates a whole lot of secondary cosmic rays and ultraviolet particles and things like this come cascading down. And so,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Your Geiger counter or scintillation counter will give you a background count. An awful lot of that background count is cosmic ray cascading events coming through the atmosphere. The most potent cosmic ray detected to date is 10 to the 20 power electron volts. 10 to the 20 power. If you read the January issue of Scientific American, you will see that the most potent gamma ray they've measured to date is 10 to the 20 power, beyond what they thought was possible. They think it is a cluster of black holes in the middle of a very active galaxy that's doing it, and it's a relatively nearby galaxy that's doing it. So, to make a telescope for these kind of things is quite difficult, because your ordinary lens is transparent to these things. They're so energetic, it would go right through a ordinary lens and say nothing is there. So, focusing them, even the techniques that had to be used for the gamma ray telescope that's being put up next spring are pretty exotic techniques. And if you go to the right website, you can read about that. But so, they thought they knew what was the upper energy limit of those particles that come flying at us from space. And these new particles at 10 to the 20 power electron volts for each individual particle. And the particle itself is believed to be a proton left over from some nucleus that somehow got accelerated by a supermassive black hole and got thrown at us. And there's quite a few of these things coming at us. Thank goodness the atmosphere stops them, but the energy that we're seeing coming through the collision with the air molecules tells us that combined with a couple of the space probes that we got are telling us that there are things out there of 10 to the 20 power of electron volts of energy, of cosmic rays. And so I can tell on the drawing board right now, or eventually is going to be a cosmic ray telescope. Each time you look at a different spectrum, a different octave of the spectrum from DC to cosmic rays, and you look at the universe, you see different things. The universe ain't simple. Back to you, Mel. And for us amateurs to radiate cosmic rays, to have the right energy to do that, that's going to take us a while. But I bet you the first guy who does it is a ham radio operator. KQKUI, KQRIW.
Okay, very good. Very interesting. All right, so actually when we get so-called, I could say, the suntan, we're dealing with the ultraviolet light, which is adjacent, I guess, to visible light. But we're actually being exposed at the same time in that same area, I guess, infrared, the sun actually, I guess, is radiating, if you say that's what's making us tan, is the ultraviolet, then most likely it also contains, I guess, a certain amount of X-rays, and, I guess, gamma rays, I could say, cosmic rays, all this stuff, all coming from the sun. So if you really wanted to look at it, then, and they carry on with cell phones, that are detrimental, putting up cell antennas and everything, which is so much different, lower in frequency and all. Basically, I would say if you said to somebody, you're doing more harm to yourself standing outside because of the ultraviolet than you were getting from the cell antenna. Am I correct, over?
All by a long shot. When you hold that cell phone up against your head, the amount of RF energy coupled into your head is safe. It's been confirmed by many means. It's safe. But it's a million times louder than the amount of energy you would get if you lived directly next door to the cell phone base station. Because of the inverse square law and the distance between that antenna and you, that cell phone base station is a million times safer than the cell phone against your head. Now, the sun is putting out a very wide spectrum of energy. The far infrared and the near infrared, most of it doesn't get through the atmosphere. The total energy of those photons is small enough that it doesn't do any cellular modification. It's mostly heat rays. The infrared from the sun, far infrared, near infrared, you could call it heat rays. And there are certain portions of the atmosphere that let through certain portions of that. The atmosphere has a very nice transparency hole between 400 and 700 millimicrons, nanometers, 400 and 700 nanometers. That's the optical spectrum. There's a nice hole in the atmosphere, optically speaking, where it's nice and transparent. The atmosphere is starting to become opaque when you get to ultraviolet. Only on a high sun, clear day does the really potent ultraviolet rays, which are now beginning to be ionizing rays, do they come through the atmosphere and are capable of giving you sunburn. The more energetic rays than far ultraviolet, the beginning of X-rays, soft X-rays and hard X-rays, do not penetrate the atmosphere directly. They hit the atmosphere, they get stopped by those air molecules, particularly the ozone air molecules, and very little of it gets through. Most of it, what gets through is secondary events. In other words, an X-ray comes along, hits an air molecule, blasts the air molecule apart into positive and negative ions, and those negative and positive ions come cascading down. It's like a bowling ball experiment, if you know what I mean. So the far ultraviolet and the soft and hard X-rays don't really penetrate the atmosphere. That atmosphere is a beautiful filter. If you're an unprotected astronaut in space, life is very different. And you've got to have special protection in your suit to protect you from these other things. That atmosphere and that magnetic field around the Earth deflects an awful lot of stuff that would be hitting you. And life on this planet probably wouldn't exist without that atmosphere and without that magnetic field. And this little bit of stuff that still hits the top of the atmosphere from the sun, the solar winds, these particles come flying out of the sun at roughly a million miles an hour. The ones that hit the top of the atmosphere, we call them aurora borealis and aurora australis. That's the glow that they create when those particles hit the top of the atmosphere. They're directed into that portion of the atmosphere by way of the magnetic field around the Earth. It focuses them in those areas. Very friendly. Without that magnetic field, that solar wind would slowly be peeling away the outer layers of our atmosphere, like Mars. Mars is believed to once have an atmosphere, but because it doesn't have a magnetic field, the solar wind slowly peeled away that atmosphere, and now the atmosphere that's left on Mars is 0.7% of the atmosphere we have on Earth. It probably had a full atmosphere at one time. It probably had a full complement of water at one time, blasted there by all of the comets. It is believed that all the water we have on this planet was deposited here by comets. Well, those exact same comets were hitting Mars. But Mars has lost most of its water vapor and most of its atmosphere because of what the cosmic wind did. And so these really potent energy levels of soft X-ray, hard X-ray, gamma ray, and cosmic rays, essentially all of them get stopped by the atmosphere. The combination of the magnetic field and the atmosphere, it's a beautiful shield. Yeah. When you watch Star Trek and Scotty is told to put up the shields, well, Mother Nature's done that for us. And the thoroughness of those particular shields is enough to make some people turn very spiritual. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Yes, Roger, very good. Okay, it's a lot to the spectrum then, you know, that meets the eye. There's an awful lot going on out there. And, yeah, I guess, like you say, the radio spectrum as we know it is constantly expanding, so I assume that the experiments that are now into, like you say, the sub-millimeter and all, there's a whole different type of instruments involved and things that we don't usually as ham radio operators don't simply recognize. Okay, I think, let's see, almost midnight, I don't think we should have thought anything else, but get late. K2RIW and the tech net, please, KTY.
Yeah, we've gone pretty far and wide tonight. DC to cosmic rays. DC to gamma rays. Cosmic rays. Alrighty. Have a nice holiday, you guys. Be kind to each other. Let's see now. We won't be hitting New Year's next weekend, so I think you and I will probably be back next weekend. And back to you, Mel, for your closing comments.
Thanks, Rocket. As I said earlier, yes, I wish everybody out there who celebrates Christmas to have a great Christmas. And Dick, thanks, Charlene, for that nice letter. Bono and I read it, and I'm always interested to hear what your kids are doing and all and everything that's going on. So we appreciate it. And we'll catch up with you folks next week. Take care. Be very careful if you're going to travel, you know, on this weekend. The next couple of days for the Christmas holiday, and the weather should be, they said, fairly good, but, you know, that means there's going to be a lot of traffic out there, so we want you all back next week. 73 ball, take care. This is KTKY.
Bye-bye, you all.
That was a great session. Thank you very much. A rare treat, a wonderful Christmas present. And it certainly shows there's a grand design from someone who's a little smarter than each and every one of us. Great class, Dick. Thank you very much. WW2WW.
Bye-bye. Great. You appreciate it.